Hello, and welcome to Western Civ, episode 251, The Martyr King and the Puppet King. Last week, Pizarro tried to figure out what to do with his newfound captive, the Inca Emperor Atahualpa. Just as he hoped, by capturing the Inca Emperor, Pizarro had effectively cut the head off the Inca military/political system. The Incan generals would not order their men to attack Pizarro, so long as he held their emperor captive. This bought Pizarro some desperately needed time. One of his first actions was to fire off a frantic message to Panama for more men. But that would take time. For now, he had a captive and pliant emperor, but how long would that last? Today, Atahualpa realizes that no matter how many rooms of gold and silver he gives Pizarro, it will never be enough. Today, one emperor dies a martyr, and another takes his place. Diego de Almagro finally returned to Peru in 1533 with more men and supplies, both of which Pizarro desperately needed. When he arrived, someone told Almagro that the natives would not attack him or his men because Pizarro currently held Atahualpa captive. But there was also a message for Almagro to get to Pizarro as quickly as possible. No one knew how long the status quo was going to last. By now, Almagro and Pizarro had been partners for at least 14 years. Theirs had been a bumpy relationship as of late. When Pizarro returned from Spain to Panama in 1529 with a royal license to conquer the Inca Empire, a realm that he was authorized to plunder for a distance of 200 leagues, or in that distance nowadays, 700 miles, he had also returned with the title of Governor of Peru. In addition, Pizarro had secured for himself the military title of Captain General of Peru. Yet in contrast to his own multiple titles, Pizarro had brought back just a single title for his loyal partner, Almagro, that of Mayor of Tumbes, an area that we are told covered a span of maybe a few square miles, and that now lay desolate and in ruins. This was despite the fact that, during their previous voyage, Almagro had rescued Pizarro and his starving followers on an island off the coast of Colombia, and despite the fact that it had been Almagro who had raised the funds to send Pizarro to Spain in the first place. Not surprisingly, Pizarro's partner had been furious upon hearing the news that he had been totally short-changed. Pizarro, however, still needed Almagro. He needed his organizational skills. He needed his ability to find and enlist fresh recruits. He needed his capacity to do the lion's share of the 1,001 things that the outfitting and expedition of the conquest of the New World required. Almagro, on the other hand, had been completely outmaneuvered. It was Pizarro who had been granted permission to conquer Peru, not he. And even if he refused now to participate, there was nothing he could do to prevent Pizarro from leaving for Peru without him. Ultimately, Almagro wanted his own realm to govern, and was furious about the turn of events. Pizarro likely had to use all his bargaining abilities, but he finally convinced his partner that if Almagro continued to help him, then he would use his influence to get Charles V to grant Almagro his own governorship outside the territories Pizarro currently controlled. Almagro took it, because he really didn't have a better option. In the end, he decided to bury the hatchet and see if he could make things work. So it was in April 1533 that Almagro rode with his men down into the city of Cajamarca. Pizarro greeted him, briefly introduced him to a stunned Atahualpa, and then took him on a tour of the guarded chamber, steadily filling with gold and silver objects. Doubtless, Almagro had to put on his best poker face in order to keep his jaw from falling straight to the floor. But underneath the outward displays of comradeship, tensions between the two partners remained. Even before Almagro had arrived, Pizarro had heard rumors that his partner might attempt to conquer Peru on his own. Almagro made no such move, however, nor any signs of it, nor were such rumors ever discussed. In truth, Pizarro had always and would always consider Almagro his sidekick, a subordinate. Despite their legal partnership, to Pizarro, Peru and the titles that came with conquering Peru were his and his alone. He was willing to share a certain amount of wealth and power with Almagro, but Pizarro never considered his partner his equal. With Almagro's arrival, there were now 300 Spaniards in Cajamarca. However, these men were part of two very distinct groups based on when they had arrived. The 168 men who had been with Pizarro from the start were forever referred to as the, quote, men of Cajamarca, end quote, the mythical founders of Spanish Peru. Crucially, these men were all entitled to a share of Atahualpa's ransom. The newcomers were not. The Spaniards who had just arrived would receive only a token share of Atahualpa's treasure. Not everyone was happy about this, of course. According to Pedro Pizarro, again, Francisco's cousin, quote, Almagro did not want the unequal division to be that way, but rather that he and his companion, Pizarro, each take half of everything, and that to the rest of the Spaniards they give 1,000 or at most 2,000 pesos each. In this, however, the Marquis behaved very Christianly, for he did not deprive anyone of what he merited. Since this distribution was made among all the Spaniards who entered Cajamarca and who took part in the capture of Atahualpa, nothing was given to those who came afterwards, end quote. Of course, one of those who, quote-unquote, came afterwards and would be given next to nothing was Pizarro's own partner, Diego de Almagro. On June the 13th, 1533, two Spanish scouts from Cusco arrived alongside a convoy of 223 llama loads of gold and silver. If each llama carried an average load of 50 pounds of gold, then the caravan would have added more than 11,000 pounds of gold and silver to Pizarro's haul. 4 days later, with tensions growing among the Spaniards and a room full of gold on his hands, Pizarro ordered that the job of melting and assaying the gold begin. He ordered that the silver, which had already been melted down, be distributed. Eventually, during a 4-month period from March to July 1533, the Spaniards fed more than 40,000 pounds of sacred Inca gold and silver into the furnaces. Roughly half of the Spaniards watched this process with mounting joy, while the other half with mounting envy. Pound after pound of the finest objects crafted by the empire's craftsmen were fed into the fires. Gold and silver statues, jewelry, platings, vessels, ornaments, and other works of art, all reduced to formless red-hot puddles and then poured into steaming molds to make ingots. Today, Incan objects of gold and silver are supremely rare, almost all having disappeared nearly 500 years ago into the furnaces of Cajamarca. The amount that the 168 men of Cajamarca stood to gain from the endeavor was staggering. Each horseman received 180 pounds of silver and 90 pounds of 22.5-carat gold. 1 pound of gold represented 2 years of a common sailor's salary. Thus, the gold alone, not counting the silver, amounted to 180 years' worth of wages all in one go. The foot soldiers got about half that amount. The 168 Spaniards who arrived with Pizarro were now richer than they ever could have imagined. Francisco Pizarro was just getting started. He had no intention of retiring. Pizarro had come to Peru not to retire. He had come to create a feudal kingdom for himself and his progeny. Immediately after Pizarro distributed the gold and silver, he allowed the conquistadors with families back in Spain to return to their wives and their children. But the rest he ordered to remain because he was far from finished. One of those slated to return to Spain briefly was Hernando Pizarro, his brother. Hernando did not have a family, but Pizarro needed someone to escort the royal fifth back to King Charles, and he picked his brother as the man to do it. Frankly, he didn't trust anyone else with 20% of Atahualpa's gold. King Charles, by the way, really comes out of this looking like the smartest guy on the block. He did nothing more than sign a few documents. And for that minimal amount of effort, he now found himself richer by 5,200 pounds of silver and 2,600 pounds of gold. Sadly, all of this would be fed into a new furnace to fund Spain's pointless Italian and soon religious wars. As Hernando Pizarro and the small group of departing Spaniards prepared to leave, many of the conquistadors who were staying behind hurriedly wrote letters to send with them. The only surviving letter from the group was written by one of Francisco Pizarro's pages, Gaspar de Garate, a young Basque in his early 20s from northern Spain. Like his compatriots, Gaspar was eager to tell his family the surprising news of his recent good fortune. It's an interesting letter, so I'm going to read it in its entirety. Quote, "To my sorely missed father, it must be about 3 years ago that I got a letter from you in which you asked me to send some money. God knows how sorry I was not to have anything to send to you then, because if I had had anything then, there wouldn't have been any need for you to write. I've always tried to do the right thing, but there wasn't any possibility till now. I'm sending you 213 pesos, 2.1 pounds, of good gold in a bar with an honorable man from San Sebastian. In Seville, he'll have it turned into coin and then bring it to you. I'd send you more, except he's taking money for other people and he couldn't take more. His name is Pedro de Anandel, I know him, and he's the kind of person who will get the money to you, so that's why I asked him to do me a favor and take you the money. I'll tell you something of my life since I came to these parts. You must know how we got some news, how Governor Francisco Pizarro was coming to be governor of this kingdom of New Castile. And so hearing this news, and having few prospects in Nicaragua, we came to this district where there's more gold and silver and iron than in Biscay, and more sheep, llamas, than in the province of Soria, and more supplies of all kind of provisions, and fine clothing, and lords among them. Just one of them rules over 500 leagues. Today that's 1,750 miles. We have him, he's talking about Atahualpa, in our power, and with him prisoner, a man can go by himself 500 leagues without getting killed. Instead, they give you whatever you need and carry you on their shoulders in the litter. We took this lord by a miracle of God, because our forces wouldn't be enough to take him, nor to do what we did, but God gave us the victory miraculously over him. You must know that we came here with Governor Francisco Pizarro to this land of this lord, where he had 60,000 warriors, and there were 160 Spaniards with the governor. And we thought our lives were finished because there was such a horde of them. And even then the native women were making fun of us and saying they were sorry for us because we were going to get killed. But afterward their bad thoughts turned out opposite. Give my greetings to Catalina and my brothers and sisters, my uncle and his daughters, especially the older one, and also to my cousins and to the rest of my relatives. I really want to tell them hello from me and that I greatly wish to see them, and pleasing God, I'll be there soon. The only thing I want to ask you is to do good for the souls of my mother and all my relatives. If God's let me get there, I'll do it thoroughly myself. I suppose there is nothing more to write at present except that I'm praying to our Lord Jesus Christ to let me see you before I die. From Cajamarca, in the Kingdom of New Castile, July the 20th, 1533. Your son, Gaspar." The writer of that letter, however, would never see Spain again. He died fighting in Peru 4 months after handing the letter and a bar of gold to his friend. As Atahualpa watched Hernando Pizarro prepare to depart for Spain, he fell into despair. Atahualpa had been close to Hernando. Hernando Pizarro may have been arrogant and the least liked of the Pizarro clan, but he had been a good friend and ally to the Inca emperor. With Hernando gone, Atahualpa no doubt pondered what would become of him. According to legend, Atahualpa begged Hernando to take him with him to Spain. He said that if Hernando left him in Peru alone, then those left with him would surely put him to death. We have no way of knowing if this exchange ever happened, But if it did, it was a prescient moment. Rumors now began to swell that Atahualpa had sent a secret message to one of his generals to come and rescue him. A local chief even told Pizarro that an Incan army was already on its way south. Quote, "And that all these men are marching under a great commander called Luminibi, and are very close to here. They will come by night and will attack this camp, setting it entirely on fire. The first person they will attempt to kill will be you, Pizarro, and they will release their lord Atahualpa from his prison. 200,000 such warriors are marching from Quito, along with 30,000 Caribs who eat human flesh," end quote. Pizarro immediately ordered that a permanent guard be mounted around the city, and then he went to confront Atahualpa. Atahualpa looked at him and said calmly, quote, "It is true that if any warriors were coming, they would be marching here from Quito on my orders. Find out whether it is true, and if true, you have me in your power, and you can execute me," end quote. According to one eyewitness, quote, "He said all this without betraying any sign of anxiety, and he said many other brilliant things that a quick-witted man would make surely during his capture. The Spaniards who heard them were amazed to see so much wisdom in a barbarian," end quote. Atahualpa's arguments didn't do him any good. Pizarro wasn't taking any chances. He ordered a large chain fastened around Atahualpa's neck going forward. And immediately, the Spanish camp began debating the emperor's future. One group wanted to execute Atahualpa immediately. Pizarro and another group wanted to keep him alive. Like a hung jury, the Spaniards were unable to agree on whether Atahualpa had been sending out secret messages or had been telling the truth. Thus, they couldn't agree on whether they should execute the Inca lord or spare his life. In order to address their most immediate threat, Pizarro decided to send Hernando de Soto with 4 horsemen to ride north and investigate. If they found no native army, then it was possible that Atahualpa had been telling the truth. But if, on the other hand, they found an army, then one thing was certain. Before the Spaniards died, Atahualpa would. After De Soto and his men had galloped off, the rest of the Spaniards were just waiting nervously. Pizarro and his captains, meanwhile, unanimously agreed on one point. Their next step would be to march south and seize Cusco, the capital of the empire and the wealthiest and the grandest of its cities. But with Cusco some 600 miles to the south, and the Inca road leading there apparently crossing over some of the roughest terrain in the world, Pizarro and his captains worried that they would not be able to prevent Atahualpa from being rescued by Inca troops during the journey. Their isolated Spanish force would be much more vulnerable while traveling, and they would inevitably find themselves exposed amid unknown terrain. According to 3 Spaniards who had helped loot Cusco, in fact, there were probably 1,000 places where Pizarro's force could be successfully ambushed along the way. If Atahualpa was rescued, then the emperor would easily galvanize the entire country to rise up against them. That very evening, after dinner, a Nicaraguan servant, a native from Peru, arrived, bearing a message. In fact, a large army had been spotted, advancing towards Cajamarca, only 11 miles away. Pizarro rose and began questioning the servant, who must have spoke some basic Spanish. The servant described in great detail what he had seen, and it became obvious that there was a threat. Pizarro quickly sent word to his men to prepare themselves for battle. By now, the tide in support of Atahualpa had turned. With the sudden and frightening threat of an impending attack, it didn't take long for those who had gathered to make a decision. Atahualpa had to be put to death. The last thing to do was to get the reluctant Pizarro, who found himself no longer able to support his earlier view that they were better off with Atahualpa alive, on their side. An entire native army could not be marching against them with Atahualpa having ordered it. Pizarro came to this conclusion on his own. And since Atahualpa had committed treason, at least according to the Spaniards' way of thinking, Pizarro finally gave the order that the Inca Emperor, quote, should die by burning, unless he be converted to Christianity, end quote. And so the son of Huanacapac, who had fought to gain the Inca throne for years before the Spaniards arrived, was quickly informed of the Spaniards' decision. Not surprisingly, he was devastated. Quote, Atahualpa wept openly and said they shouldn't kill him, for there wasn't one Indian in the country who would make trouble without his command. And since they had him prisoner, what were they afraid of? End quote. Atahualpa tried, without success, to convince his captors that the empire would devolve into chaos if he were executed. And so Atahualpa tried a last-ditch effort to save his life. Quote, if they were going to do it, kill him, for gold or silver, then he would give them twice what he had already commanded, end quote. But this time the gold didn't even seem to register. At this point, the Spaniards were so terrified of this alleged army, they were acting on cruise control. According to Pedro Pizarro, quote, I saw the governor, that is Francisco Pizarro, weep from sorrow at being able to grant him his life, but he feared the consequences and risked the country if he were released, end quote. Pizarro, however, along with the rest of the Spanish leaders, were now convinced about one thing. If a native army was less than 11 miles outside of town, then that army could launch an attack the very evening. Thus, in terms of keeping their hostage from falling into enemy hands, there was no time to lose. Atahualpa had to be put to death immediately. The sun was just beginning to set on Saturday, July 26th, 1533, when the emperor of the Inca, Atahualpa, was led out to the main square of Cajamarca. The Spaniards surrounded him and sounded the trumpet and began reading out aloud the charges against the emperor. Atahualpa was tied to a stake that had just been impaled into the ground. A bunch of natives came out to watch, and for the ordinary native inhabitant, watching the Spaniards prepare for the execution of their lord and god was probably as frightening as knowing that the sun was about to disappear. The Incas, after all, believed that their history was a succession of ages divided from one to another by a cataclysmic event. This had begun with the very formation of the Inca Empire. Now, as the natives watched their lord Atahualpa being tied to a stake, many believed that this part of the world, this epoch, was, in fact, coming to an end. According to Pedro Pizarro, who again gives us most of our information about this period, quote, when he, Atahualpa, was taken out to be killed, all the native people who were on the square, and there were many, prostrated themselves on the ground, letting themselves fall to the earth like drunken men, end quote. Some of the Spaniards began gathering wood, while others began stacking it in preparation for a fire around Atahualpa's feet. The Dominican friar spoke to the emperor through one of the interpreters. Quote, he instructed him in the things of our Christian faith, telling him that God had wished him to die for the sins he had committed in the world, and that he should repent of them, and that God would pardon him if he did. It is, of course, impossible to know if Atahualpa actually understood any of the things that were being said to him. No doubt, though, Atahualpa was distressed by all this. He had done everything that the strangers had asked for. Yet, now some unfriendly man in a dark robe was threatening him with death by fire if he didn't accept the invaders' one and only God, whom the invaders called Dios. From this point on, it seems like Atahualpa had made peace with his fate. His concern was now only with his two small sons, which he had left in Quito, and which were, for the moment, safe. At one point, he suggested Francisco Pizarro take responsibility for them himself. Atahualpa said that he was entrusting his children to the governor, but the friar advised him to forget his wives and children, and to die like a Christian, and that if he wanted to become one, that he must receive the holy baptismal water. But Atahualpa wept greatly and continued to insist that his children be cared for, indicating their heights with his hand and making it clear through his gestures that they were small, but that he was leaving them unprotected in Quito. Yet the father continued to try to induce him to convert to Christianity and to forget his children, telling him that Governor Pizarro would look after them and would treat them as his own, end quote. But ultimately, Atahualpa agreed to convert to Christianity. Whether he did this out of true religious conviction, to save himself from being burned alive, or save his children, or even some combination of those factors, I cannot say. As the sky began to turn red from the setting sun, several Spaniards fastened around Atahualpa's neck a garrote, a type of rope attached to a stick that could be turned like a wheel, tightening the loop till the blood supply to the carotid arteries was cut off to the brain. As the friar began intoning the last rites, one of the Spaniards began to twist the stick, the rope slowly tightening around Atahualpa's neck. For those of you who may be surprised by this, the conversion to Christianity was never to save Atahualpa's life. It was just to change the manner of the execution. Finally, the emperor's eyes began to bulge, and the solitary vein in his forehead rose, inflamed by the final rays of the sun. A notary present wrote as follows, "With these last words, and with the Spaniards who surrounded him, saying a credo for his soul, he, Atahualpa, was strangled. May God receive him in heaven, for he died repenting of his sins and in the true faith of a Christian. After he had been strangled in this way, and the sentence executed, some fire was thrown on him to burn part of his clothing and flesh. That night, because he died late in the afternoon, his body was left in the square, so that everyone could learn of his death." Another notary wrote, "He died on Saturday, at the same hour that he was taken prisoner and defeated 8 months earlier. Some said it was for his sins that he died on the same day, Saturday, and same hour that he was seized." So ended the life of Atahualpa, the 31-year-old lord of the Incas, the first Inca emperor in over 100 years, who had not only failed to expand the empire, but who had instead presided over the beginning of its collapse. For the second time in less than a decade, beginning with Huayna Capac's death by smallpox, the Inca Empire was suddenly without a ruler. Governors, administrators, generals, and accountants still busied themselves with their daily tasks, but now there was no one to give them orders. And from this moment forward, the Inca Empire was essentially paralyzed. With Atahualpa dead, the Spaniards immediately readied themselves for an attack, which they believed was imminent. But as night turned to morning, and as the sun rose once more into the sky, no attack came. Reprieved for the moment from the immediate necessity to fight, the Spaniards now found themselves confronted with a more mundane problem. What do you do with Atahualpa's corpse? Everyone agreed he couldn't just leave the Inca Emperor lying on the square. Atahualpa had been revered as a god, after all. And the natives continued to prostrate themselves on the square, distraught. Pizarro finally decided that the sooner they got rid of the corpse, the better. After a brief ceremony, Atahualpa's stiff, blackened body was interred in a hastily dug hole. A few days after Atahualpa's burial, Spanish sentries finally sighted Hernando de Soto and his horsemen coming back from reconnoitering. Unaware of what had happened in their absence, and assuming that Atahualpa was still alive, de Soto rode back in a flourish and dismounted in the square. He immediately hurried off in search of Pizarro. De Soto must have wondered at the somber mood when he got back, and finding Pizarro wearing, quote, a large felt hat on his head as if for mourning, end quote. Presumably, looking about in vain for Atahualpa, de Soto quickly informed Pizarro that he and his men had found nothing. The rumors of the army were false. Atahualpa had been telling the truth. Pizarro responded mournfully, catching De Soto completely by surprise. According to those present, Pizarro quietly said, I see now that I have been deceived. Pizarro then told De Soto that they had strangled Atahualpa a few days earlier, after news reports had arrived of an approaching Inca army. Obviously, he said, those reports had been false. De Soto was also deeply disappointed by Atahualpa's death. And in an emotional, De Soto quickly told Pizarro that it would have been much better to send Atahualpa to Spain, and that he himself would have gladly escorted him there. He had killed the emperor for no reason. No justifiable reason at all, De Soto said. He then turned on his heels and left the room. News of Atahualpa's death slowly began to make its way northward from Peru, across the Isthmus of Panama, and eventually, via a ship, to Spain. Meanwhile, Pizarro and Almagro had more closer matters to deal with. There were roughly 300 Spaniards readied themselves for another major military campaign. Pizarro's plan was to begin a bold military thrust southward along the rugged spine of the Andes. No longer protected by a hostage emperor that they could count on to keep the native armies at bay, they would now be forced to entrust their fates to their lances, swords, to their solitary god. Yet capturing Atahualpa had been the equivalent of seizing the brain or command center of the empire, then Pizarro was now determined to fight his way southward in order to capture its heart, the legendary city of Cuzco. He also knew, though, that another Inca army lurked somewhere to his rear. How those native armies would behave, how the commanding generals would now move, no one could predict. Pizarro and his men spent the next 3 months working their way south. The 300 conquistadors were now joined by a larger retinue of native slaves from what is today Nicaragua, some African slaves, and local natives. Together, they all worked to move Atahualpa's treasure to the coast from whence it could be transported to Panama and ultimately back to Spain. Before he and his Spaniards had left Cajamarca, however, Pizarro had decided to crown the eldest surviving brother of the Emperor Juana Capac, a royal prince called Tupac Hualpa. Pizarro hoped that by doing so, he would be able to continue controlling the Inca aristocracy, and hence the empire, much as he had done with Atahualpa. The new Inca emperor's reign, however, was short-lived. Within 2 months, Tupac Hualpa sickened and died. A disappointed Pizarro had him hastily buried, and once again, the Inca empire was without a ruler. Still, there was some good news. Pizarro and his men had been able to gain a rough idea, at least, of where the existing Inca armies were deployed. Invaluable information for the still relatively tiny group of foreigners. Essentially, they learned that there were 3 Inca armies in the field. One to the north, in what is today Ecuador with 30,000 troops. Another in central Peru, numbered around 35,000. And a third in Cusco, 30,000 strong. The army in central Peru, Pizarro quickly dealt with. Even before leaving Cajamarca, he had decapitated the central army by luring its general, Chachumichi, to visit the imprisoned Atahualpa. After seizing Chachumichi, Pizarro decided to bring the imprisoned Inca general along on his journey. Pizarro had grown suspicious, however, that the general might be able to incite local natives to attack, and had thus burned the man at the stake. This meant now that only the army in Cusco, commanded by General Quisquis, stood between the Spaniards and their goal of capturing the capital of the Inca Empire. In November 1533, the army of the Spaniards was now only a day's march from Cusco. Here, they encountered a 17-year-old boyish-looking native who wore a yellow tunic and who was accompanied by a group of Inca nobles. Pizarro's interpreters soon learned that the young native was the son of the Emperor Juana Capac, and thus was of royal descent. Pizarro also learned that the teenage boy's name was Manco Inca, and that, although he was the brother of both Atahualpa and Huascar, he was also one of the very few survivors of Huascar's royal lineage. As Pizarro and his captains listened to their interpreter translating, the young prince explained how he'd been living as a fugitive, and spent much of the previous year, quote, fleeing constantly from Atahualpa's men, so they would not kill him. He came so alone and abandoned he looked like a common Indian, end quote. Pizarro quickly realized not only was Manco Inca a possible heir to the throne, but that the royal prince also belonged to Inca's Cusco faction, precisely the faction that Pizarro wished to be perceiving as allying himself with. Since Pizarro had already executed Atahualpa, nothing could be better than for him to arrive in Cusco with a member of the same faction that had suffered under Atahualpa. Pizarro and his troops could thus position themselves as liberators, a perception they hoped would forestall any native resistance from developing. According to one chronicler, quote, Manco Inca said to the governor that he would help him all that he could in order to rid the land of those from Quito, which was Atahualpa's faction. For they were her enemies, and they hated him. Manco was the man to whom, by law, came all that province, and whose chief it wanted for its lord. When he came to see Pizarro, he came by way of the mountains, avoiding the roads for fear of those from Quito. Pizarro was happy to receive him and told him, a lot of what you say pleases me, including your great desire to be rid of these men from Quito. You should know that I have come for no other purpose than to prevent them from doing you harm, and to free you from your slavery to them. And you can be sure that I'm not coming here for my own benefit. But knowing the injuries they were inflicting on you, I wanted to come and rectify and undo them, as my lord, the emperor, commanded me to do. You can thus be sure that I will do everything I can to help you, and that I will also do the same to liberate the people of Cusco from this tyranny. The governor, Pizarro, made these big promises to Manco Inca in order to please him, so that he, Pizarro, might get news of how things were going elsewhere. The chief, Manco Inca, was marvelously satisfied, as were those who had come with him. End quote. Pizarro hoped that by allying himself with the young Inca prince, he could fool the Cusco faction into believing his only real interest was in placing those who had been oppressed by Atahualpa back into power. But before he could install Manco as the new emperor, Pizarro had to capture Cusco. Manco told Pizarro that the Inca general in charge there intended to burn the city to the ground rather than watch it fall into Spanish hands. This news touched a nerve with Pizarro. He knew full well that the only knock against Hernan Cortes was his inability to take control of Tenochtitlan. Cortes had been forced to destroy his jewel of a capital city in order to win his war against the Mexica. Pizarro desperately wanted to avoid that fate. So he dispatched his 23-year-old brother Juan Pizarro and Hernando de Soto with 40 horsemen in an effort to prevent the burning of the capital. After 18 months of war in Peru, the Spanish were now supremely confident. The attrition rates of the native and Spanish troops had thus far been decidedly in the Spaniards' favor. Beginning with the capture of Atahualpa, the Inca had lost more than 8,000 warriors, many high-ranking nobles, one of their three key generals, and, obviously, their emperor. The Spaniards, by contrast, had thus far lost one African slave. Though relatively few in number, the Spaniards possessed a number of advantages over the Inca in terms of military technology. Perhaps their greatest monopoly was on horses, animals that could carry a fully armored Spaniard and outrun the fastest native. These were the mobile tanks of conquest. They also provided a high platform from which the Spaniards could use their 12-foot metal-tipped lance and strike downward with their swords. Pizarro's conquistadors also possessed gunpowder, a limited number of cannon, and an assortment of harquebuses. In terms of their ability to defend themselves, the Spaniards' superior armor protected them from just about anything that the Inca could throw at them. We have the following account from Atahualpa's nephew, who described just how difficult it was from the Inca perspective to do any damage to these automatons. Quote, they seemed like virocas, which is the name we give in ancient times to the creator of all things. And they, the Incas, named those people whom they had seen in this way, in part because they were very different in clothing and appearance, and also because they rode giant animals, which had feet of silver. And they said this because of the shining of the horseshoes. They called them virochas because of their excellent appearance and because of the great differences there were amongst them. Some had black beards, others red ones, and because they saw them eat off silver plates, and because they could produce thunder from heaven, end quote. Besides their arms and armor, the Spaniards possessed other advantages over the Inca. They could effectively communicate by writing. They had access to a slow, but still useful international trade network. Plus, they had recent battle experience fighting the Moors. The Reconquista is hardly one generation old. Plus, though they did not realize it, the Spanish had a more deadly weapon on their side than horses and steel. Smallpox. Only 5 years before, the Inca Empire had been united and strong. Smallpox not only devastated the Inca population, but it also triggered the civil war Pizarro was able to take advantage of upon his arrival, in which he hoped to use to his advantage again. It's worth noting at this point that for all their sophistication, the Inca remained essentially a Stone Age or perhaps Bronze Age people. The Inca had copper and tin, though they didn't use it primarily to produce bronze. Even if they did, the Inca didn't know anything of iron ore. Iron ore, in fact, would not be discovered in Peru until 1915. Hence, even if you granted the Inca another 300 years to develop their civilization, there's a real chance that they would not have been much farther along in terms of technology. The Inca had the numbers, but they were about to face steel armor with stone clubs. Not a recipe for success. These clubs were incapable of penetrating steel armor. As we're going to continue to see, while the Spanish will suffer a small number of casualties and a lot of injuries, these pale in comparison to the damage the Spanish can do with lances and swords, capable of slicing through limbs and killing a man where he stands. Despite their much greater number of troops, the Incas operated under a variety of other disadvantages. They didn't have writing. They only had this thing called the quipus, which allowed them to send less information back and forth than the Spaniards. Essentially, it was a way to count numbers. They had little knowledge of the world beyond their frontiers. They were totally unaware of the Spanish conquests of Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. And they didn't know anything about the history of Europe or the rest of the world. Moreover, it should go without saying that the Inca possessed no advanced armor. They had some bronze, some copper, but mostly it was just quilted cotton. And of course, they didn't have horses. On November the 14th, 1533, Juan Pizarro and Hernando de Soto reached the outskirts of Cusco. Here they found the road blocked by a massive Inca army, which outnumbered them 750-1. Despite this numerical inferiority, the Spanish decided to attack immediately. Throughout their time in the New World, the Spanish had learned that a direct and immediate attack was the best policy when it came to confronting an indigenous army. It worked for Cortes, and so far, it worked for Pizarro. The native warriors, quote, in the greatest numbers, came out against us with an enormous shout and much determination. With their backs against the city, and the experienced General Quisquis in charge, the northern army of Quito fought fiercely, driving the Spaniards back in an onslaught of sling-fired arrows, stones, and battering mace clubs. One notary wrote, quote, they killed three of our horses, including my own, and wounded many others, end quote. Protected by their armor and fighting from their horses, however, The Spaniards exacted a tremendous toll. Hundreds of natives fell that day in fighting that continued until late in the afternoon, with human limbs and heads lying on the ground after having been severed with sharpened steel. The Spaniards, by comparison, with stones and mace heads bouncing off their steel armor, received many wounds but didn't suffer a single casualty. The Spanish used all of their advantages tremendously. If the Spaniards were in trouble, others on horseback could charge towards the group. If the Spaniards needed to escape a difficult situation, then they could spur their horses and outrun even the fastest native warriors. Late in that day, Francisco Pizarro and the rest of the troops arrived, but only after the Spanish cavalry force and Quisqui's troops had ceased their fighting. With darkness falling, the Inca and Spanish forces camped within sight of each other. One man wrote, quote, "The Spaniards set up their camp on a plain, and the Indians stayed on a harquebus shot away on a slope until midnight, continuously shouting. The Spaniards spent all night with their horses saddled and bridled." The next day, at the crack of dawn, the governor organized the foot soldiers and cavalry, and he headed off on the road to Cusco in good order, having been warned and believing the enemy would come out and attack them on the road, end quote. But nothing happened. Apparently, realizing that on level ground, his native troops, though numerous, were no match for the mounted Spaniards, General Quisquis had decided to save his army to fight another day. It turns out, just after midnight, Quisquis had given the order for his troops to retreat and give up the fight for Cusco. They did so quietly, leaving their campfires lit behind them to fool the Spaniards into thinking that they were still there. The next day, around noon, the Spaniards marched victorious into the city. As they marched and rode in full battle order, the city's inhabitants turned out on the stone-paved streets to watch them. It had only been morning when the surprised citizens learned of the Northern Army from Quito, which had occupied the city for the last year, had suddenly melted away and was nowhere to be found. The citizens already knew, of course, the emperor, Atahualpa, was dead and had been executed by the same group of foreigners. More than a few of them were surprised, though, to see Manco Inca, the young prince, who most of them had not seen in a year, walking with the strange bearded men and surrounded by giant animals that made guttural noises, and that none of the city's inhabitants had ever seen before. Manco was obviously very much alive, and through his behavior and speech, the young prince made it known that the foreigners were friendly, not dangerous, that they were to be treated as honored guests. For the weary inhabitants of Cusco, the sudden disappearance of a hated occupying army was certainly a relief. Question, and no doubt, though, was who were these new foreigners? Why had they come? But at this point, clearly the strategy of allying themselves with Huascar's faction and presenting themselves as liberators was paying dividends for the Europeans. For the rank-and-file conquistador, their unopposed march into the finest city that any of them had frankly ever seen in the New World seemed nothing short of miraculous. Consider the following account. The Spaniards who had taken part in this enterprise were amazed by what they had done. When they begin to think about it, they can't imagine how they can still be alive or how they were able to survive such hardships and such long periods of hunger. We entered the city without meeting resistance, for the natives received us with goodwill. In all, only 6 Europeans had died on the 3-month, 600-mile trek from Cajamarca to Cusco. And the 17-year-old Manco Inca? Well, I mean, he was overjoyed. Ever since Atahualpa's forces had taken Cusco, he had assumed he was as good as dead. Now, with these seemingly invincible foreigners on his side, he was back at the very pinnacle of power. Pizarro was quick to consolidate his latest military triumph. Since General Quisquis' army could still mount a counterattack, Pizarro ordered his troops to quarter themselves in the larger of Cusco's two main squares. He then commanded those with horses to keep their mounts ready at all times day and night, in case of an Inca assault on the city. Not one to waste time, Pizarro also informed Manco the day after his arrival in Cusco that he would soon become the new Inca emperor. As one man described, quote, "He was a prudent and bright young man and was the most important native among those who were there at the time. And he was the one to whom by law belonged the kingdom." He, Pizarro, said all this rapidly so that the natives would not join the men of Quito, but would have a lord of their own to revere and to obey, and would not organize themselves into rebellious bands, end quote. Pizarro, despite being illiterate, seems to have had an innate understanding of how power worked. He knew that attempting to rule in his own right was folly. He needed Manco Inca to rule and to rule through him. Soon after reaching Cusco, Pizarro started pressuring Manco to recruit a native army. If he had a native army, Pizarro reasoned, then he could take care of the two remaining Inca armies and deal with any native resistance. Manco Inca dutifully raised a force of 10,000 men. Together with De Soto and 50 other cavalry officers, Manco Inca marched out of Cusco, confronted the former occupying army that had recently left the capital, and inflicted enough damage that the officers in said army decided they had had enough. The men of Quito packed up and marched north to home. This left only one Inca army in the field. After the victory, Manco Inca was officially named emperor. A puppet emperor, but emperor all the same. The Spanish were impressed by the scale of the coronation. One wrote, quote, "They held huge celebrations on the city square, and such a vast number of people assembled that only with great difficulty could the crowd fit." Manco had all the deceased ancestors brought to the festivities in the following manner. After he had gone with a great entourage to the temple to make a prayer to the sun, throughout the morning he went successively to the tombs where each dead Inca emperor was embalmed and seated on his seat. With great veneration and respect, they were then removed in the order of precedence and brought to the city, each one seated on his litter and uniformed men to carry it. Continuing, he writes, "Once they had been placed in order, they remained there from 8 in the morning until nightfall without leaving the festivities. There were so many people and so many men and women who were heavy drinkers, and they poured so much on their skins, because that is what they do, to drink and not eat, that two wide drains, over half vara, 18 inches wide, that emptied into the river beneath the flagstones of the square ran with urine throughout the day from those who had urinated into them as abundantly as if it were flowing into springs," end quote. Taking advantage of this large audience of native chiefs and nobles who had arrived to honor their new lord, Pizarro arranged to address the important gathering. Using the Spaniards' now ritualized ceremony of conquest, Pizarro soon made it clear to all those who gathered that they were part of a larger world order than they had been used to, and that henceforth they would be subservient to an empire even more powerful than their own. Quote, "Once mass had been said, he, Pizarro, came out onto the square with many men from his army, and he gathered them together, and in the presence of the emperor, the lords of the land, and the native warriors who were seated together with his own Spaniards, with the Inca emperor seated on a small stool, and with his men on the ground around him, the governor made a speech, as he is used to doing in similar situations," end quote. Of course, the Spaniards, as was their custom, then read the requerimiento. Pizarro's notary read the final paragraph, pausing now and then for the words to be interpreted into the Inca's language. "And so I request you to recognize the church as your mistress, and the governess of the world and the universe, and the high priest called the Pope in her name, and his majesty in her place, as ruler and lord king. And if you do not do this, then with the help of God we shall make mighty war against you. And we shall make war on you everywhere, and in every way that we can, and we shall subject you to the yoke and obedience of the church and his majesty," and so forth and so on. We have no idea what the native chiefs were actually thinking while all this was going on, but they came forward dutifully, one at a time, to embrace Francisco Pizarro. Then the coronation was over. The teenaged Manco Inca was the new emperor. He was the fifth Incan emperor in 6 years. Meanwhile, the Spaniards continued looting the capital, and Pizarro took up residency in the royal palace. Everything was going swimmingly from his perspective. In fact, if you were awarding points, I think now we'd need to say Pizarro had done a cleaner job of his conquest than Cortez. For now, at least. In March 1534, Pizarro distributed all the gold and silver from Cusco. For those who had arrived late, their patience now more than paid off. For those who had been in Peru from the beginning, they became millionaires many times over. Pizarro now presented his fellow Spaniards with a choice. They could return to Spain and spend the rest of their lives in luxury. Or they could remain in Peru and help found this new colony Pizarro was calling the Kingdom of New Castile. Pizarro had no intention of leaving Peru. But he couldn't rule an empire on his own, so he needed and expected some men to agree to stay with him. There were still less than 500 total Europeans in a kingdom of around 10 million. He needed every man he could get. Thus, Pizarro offered any man who would remain an encomienda. The plan was simple: restructure the Inca social pyramid. The idea was that these uneducated Spaniards would replace the Inca elite. Whether these men realized it or not, this was virtually the only time in history when a landless Spanish man could become what was essentially a feudal lord. That kind of social mobility simply did not happen in early modern Spain. But in the end, most men chose to return to their home country. 88 Spaniards accepted the encomiendas and became permanent residents of Cusco. Unaware of the Spaniards' plan, the new Inca emperor, Manco Inca, had a number of problems on his hands. He first had to take up the reins of an empire that had originally been ripped from the hands of his brother Huascar and then from the hands of his other brother Atahualpa. Manco's immediate task was to try to reestablish the authority of the emperor. While portions of the empire had continued to function on automatic autopilot, other areas had reverted to rule of local warlords and chiefs. These had taken advantage of the civil wars and of Pizarro's campaign of conquest in order to throw off the yoke of Inca domination. Seated on his royal stool, Manco now set about restoring the Inca's imperial authority as best he could for a boy of 17. Soon, the young emperor began receiving visits from his provincial governors, began appointing new ones where they had gone missing, and slowly undertook the laborious task of reestablishing the intricate governing mechanism that his ancestors and thousands of years of cultural development in the Andes had produced. The Spaniards, meanwhile, still had a very weak grasp of just how complex the empire that they had only partially conquered was. While they immediately recognized the overall similarities with the old world culture of kings, nobles, priests, and commoners, they knew little of the actual mechanisms that enabled the Inca Empire to function. The Inca's genius, like that of the Romans, for example, lay in their masterful organizational abilities. An ethnic group that probably never exceeded 100,000 individuals was able to regulate the activities of roughly 10 million people. This, in spite of the fact that the empire's citizens spoke more than 700 languages and were distributed among thousands of miles of some of the most rugged and diverse terrain in the world. The Incan economy was nearly 100% dependent on agriculture. It wasn't subsistence farming per se. Thanks to the Inca distribution system, A crop failure in one part of the empire might be compensated for by importing food from another. Thanks to the roads and terraces they built, famine had become virtually impossible. But unlike in Spain, the people of the Inca Empire held no land directly. Remember, technically all the land in the empire was owned by the emperor. He sort of leased it back to the people, who then owed a labor tax as a result. That was how the system worked. However, years of civil war, plague, and now, well, this, had left the system listing and in danger of capsizing. So in the latter half of 1534, Manco Inca actually, though a puppet emperor, spent his time trying to shore up the system as best he could. He might be relegated to a supporting role, but Manco Inca was going to do the best he could to keep his people safe and fed. Unfortunately, to some local Inca elites, who had begun to see the Spaniards as conquerors, not liberators, Manco was starting to look like a collaborator. As an aside, I don't think that's fair. Remember, he's 17 or 18 years old at this point. He doesn't understand Pizarro's full intentions. I think to judge Manco Inca based on these first few months would do him a major disservice. He was just being a bit naive. He didn't understand that Pizarro was being friendly just to stall for time until reinforcements arrive. How could he? He didn't know anything about Spain, Europe, etc., etc. At the same time, Pizarro was just beginning to realize that some of the Spanish reinforcements he had patiently been waiting for might prove more dangerous than a potential native attack. Back in March, Pizarro had learned alarming news that Hernando Cortés's second-in-command, Pedro de Alvarado, had recently landed on the coast of Ecuador with 550 Spanish conquistadors. Alvarado was evidently going to try to carve out his own governorship in the area, despite the fact that Pizarro was the only person who had a royal license to conquer any portion of the Inca Empire. Pizarro's partner, as dependable as ever, Diego de Almagro, however, hurried north as soon as he had learned the news. Unwilling to have their years of effort derailed by competition, Almagro ultimately succeeded in negotiating a peaceful resolution. In return for 100,000 pesos, about 1,000 pounds of gold, Alvarado agreed to cancel his plans of conquest, and also to allow 340 of his conquistadors to join Pizarro and Almagro in completing the conquest of Peru. The negotiations had occurred just in time. No sooner had Almagro begun to head south again than he almost immediately ran into a large Inca army commanded by the intrepid General Quisquis, who had gradually retreated northward since having abandoned Cusco more than 6 months earlier. Quisquis and his troops, having been away from their homes now for more than 2 years, were a little surprised to encounter a large Spanish army where they least expected one. The Inca general had assumed that the northern part of the empire was still free of the hated foreigners. Soon, a series of battles ensued. In one of them, Quisquis's troops successfully ambushed a group of 14 Spaniards and beheaded all of them. In another, they managed to wound 20 Spaniards and kill 3 of their horses. Still, after years of fighting, and now suddenly confronted by a force of nearly 500 Spaniards and a large number of horses, Quisquis's men were just demoralized. The vast majority of them just wanted to go home. Even more shocking to the proud Inca general was the fact that his very own officers wanted to give up the fight. There's some irony in this, because Quisquis was gradually learning how to deal with the Spanish. By stationing his men on steep hillsides, he learned that he could blunt the effectiveness of the Spanish cavalry attacks. I guess it's a little sad, then, that this is when Quisquis' life comes to an end. His officers rebelled, and in the midst of trying to quell the rebellion, the best Inca general still alive was killed by his own men. Had he lived, we have to wonder whether Quisquis might have turned things around against the Spanish. But that's yet another one of thousands of the what-ifs from history. Not long after Quisquis died, Atahualpa's final army was defeated in Ecuador by a joint Spanish-Native army. With all of Atahualpa's generals now dead, Pizarro and Almagro seemed in total control. All they needed to do was continue the process of transforming the Inca Empire into a lucrative new colony for the rapidly expanding Spanish Empire. And so Pizarro slowly began to shift his role from military leader to administrator. But of course, the elephant in the room remained the question of Almagro. What about him? He had faithfully supported Pizarro for years. Now what was to become of him? Well, in an effort to give Almagro something, Pizarro decided to make his partner the governor of Cusco. Almagro accepted, and in December 1543, he rode back up the mountains to the former capital of the Inca. Ironically, he had just left when news arrived from Spain. Shocking news. King Charles had decided to split the Inca Empire in two. Pizarro and Almagro would each get half. The northern part went to Pizarro. The southern part went to Almagro. The problem is, as we're going to see next week, Charles neglected to say exactly where the quote-unquote northern and southern parts of the empire began and ended. While Pizarro hurriedly sent a messenger after Almagro, little did he realize that this news would drive a wedge between the two conquistadors and quickly upset the delicate balance of power in the region. It turned out the conquest of the Inca had only just begun.